And over the years, I've kind of come to the conclusion that that entrepreneurship is kind of broken a little bit, or let's say it has been evolving over the years that I've been involved with the startup scene at least. And I think that the kind of one of the it will probably keep morphing, but one of the more final iterations of entrepreneurship in its whole, I think, is within the venture studio model that can be done in many different ways.
Welcome back to another episode of Nerding Out with Victor. Today, I'm joined by my good friend, Torbjørn Runje. Welcome, Torbjørn.
Hello, Victor. Good to be here.
It's good to have you. Today's episode is going to be about something that we've been chatting about quite a lot over the last few years, which is venture studios. You've taken this concept and kind of built something pretty big around this. So I guess maybe we kick things off with a quick introduction as to who's Torbjørn and what should the people know to kind of prefix the conversation.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, my name is Torbjørn, or Thor, for anyone who doesn't reside in the Nordic countries. I think that's a little bit more easy. But yeah, I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. I built a bunch of businesses. I think I've maybe been involved with 20 businesses or something that I've been part of co-founding. I've been the very first money in or pre-idea or whatever, and I have a portfolio of around 50 businesses. So there's been a lot of stuff going on. And over the years, I've kind of come to the conclusion that that entrepreneurship is kind of broken a little bit, or let's say it has been evolving over the years that I've been involved with the startup scene at least. And I think that the kind of one of the it will probably keep morphing, but one of the more final iterations of entrepreneurship in its whole, I think, is within the venture studio model that can be done in many different ways. But this whole idea of like, yeah, let's be free friends and pick a problem and spend $5 million of somebody else's money to kind of figure out, you know, all kinds of things like, I need to learn sales now, or I need to learn how to fundraise, I need to learn how to hire, I need to learn all these kind of things within that that kind of run rate. That's probably not the most efficient way to build startups, and that's probably also why if you look at VCs and investors, they love to invest in exited founders even without them having an idea, right? Because it's a little bit like their micro venture studio, because they went through the motions on everything, and it's not always about having the best practice, but just having a practice on stuff, right? So that's kind of the learning that. Yeah, so if you're an exited founder, right, you did hire people before, and the right people probably. You do know how to make a financial model. You do know how to run sales to some extent, or at least get the right salesperson involved, how to build product, find product market fit. You know all of the different components of building a business. And in the venture studio, that's really what you're doing, right? That is codify exactly what does it take to get from zero to one in the most efficient way, with the least resources spent and with the most learnings, and just power through it, right? And I'll stop there.
So before we dive into like the venture studio world, like let's actually talk what is a venture studio, because I think it's a concept been thrown around a lot over the last few years on LinkedIn and whatnot. But let's take a step back. What's your definition of a venture studio?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of confusion around because some people say a startup, or like a company factory, or it could be like a startup studio, a venture studio, an incubator, whatever, right? And probably I think that our friend Matt Burris, who is a pretty good voice in the venture studio environment, he's been doing really championing that we should be calling it venture studios, just because there's too many different so we were actually calling it startup studios, and we changed back to venture studios just to kind of be with all the other venture studio people in the environment to say, okay, let's call it this so that we can create an asset class around this, right. And just for people to understand, YC Combinator, for instance, is a incubator, tech stars, these sort of things. And the difference is, in an incubator, you bring your idea, and then there'll be a set program, and they will buy 10% at a set price. And you will be okay with that price being a little bit lower than maybe what you could get, because they will set you up with all the investors, run you through an insane program, mentors, all this kind of things, right? That's an incubator. And Venture Studio, on the other hand, it takes some of the components of the incubator, you could say a very process-oriented, playbook-oriented kind of approach to startup building, but it will own 100% per default of whatever company that it creates and take entrepreneurs in and work with them, or maybe have them on the team already and say, like, we are a company factory from the very beginning, from the idea level, right? And then obviously the founders will have equity and so forth, and there will then be many versions of Venture Studios, and probably we're going to talk a little bit about our kind of version of the Venture Studio model, because they could go in many directions, but that's the kind of core of it, right?
Yeah. I mean, the first time I heard of this kind of concept, I guess it's been done internally quite a lot over the years, right, in bigger companies, but the first time I think I heard of the concept of this kind of startup factory was probably, I'm not sure you remember, Kevin Rose had something called Milk, like way back, this must have been like 2008-ish time area. They created this startup studio, but they basically tried to, like, when mobile first was like king, and they started to spin up a bunch of these. I think eventually they folded, but that was the first time like I heard somebody codify like the definition of this. And then obviously, I guess we kind of moved from there into the YC dominated world. And now we kind of see the next generation being born in Venture Studios, right?
Yeah.
Is that how you see the market, or is that how the development is
going as well? Yeah, just to kind of add a little bit for the audience, like there is a lot of venture studios that have been very successful actually, but they've never had the same amount of clout, I think, as some of the big startups and some of the big VCs, like I don't know, Sequoia and Dresden, these type of but they are actually have created insane amounts of value. So Bill Gross with Idea Lab is like, they had 10 unicorns, 50 exits, something like that, right? That goes 25 years back. So they're like the real OGs of Venture Studios. Then you have the Rugged Internet guys, the
Of course.
Brothers.
Oh, yeah, of course.
They
yeah.
created 5 unicorns, I think, and had 5 IPOs as well. And they were kind of just taking proven models, mostly from the US, adapting them to their home turf, which is mostly Germany and
region market,
and the DACH, and also scaling it beyond that. I think there was an Africa and everywhere. That was their model. And then you have something like Sutter Hill Ventures, which I'm very inspired by. Mike Spicer. They were building companies in-house. They built like Snowflake, and I think he personally was the CEO of something like 3 or 5 different unicorns. So like they just had the blueprint, right? They know all the best people in the world, and they just followed their way of doing it. He was not actually the CEO. There's another CEO that has written a great book. Oh, I forgot his name. But
I know what you mean.
But anyways, the point is that there is
Slothman.
Exactly. Yes, it's great, this little CEO book. And he said, like, I'm going to write this book because, not because I want to write a book, but because people keep asking me fucking stupid questions about how to be a CEO. So now I'm going to write this little book, and you can all go read that.
It's a great book, though.
It's a really good book. Definitely recommend that one. Anyways, it has been done for a while. And I think that what people are kind of starting to realize is just that it's a superior model, because you can build just as much value, you can own more equity, and you can do it in a much more capital efficient way, right? Mm-hmm. And especially with the sort of in this new era of company creation, where the kind of the cost of building startups is plummeting. Maybe maybe 5-10 years ago, it'll cost you, I don't know, $2 to $5 million to really build a startup, right? Just to kind of test it out and de-risk that kind of first phase. That maybe cost you like $100,000 to $500,000 now, right? So that's a factor 10 less, right? Yes. And profitability is also interesting again, because of interest rate, because of macro, because of a lot of different things that kind of makes the unit economics of the VC model a little bit wonky, which is also one of the big reasons I think that this model then becomes interesting again. It has always been interesting, but why it's becoming more in vogue, and why we also see it as the final boss of entrepreneurship to really kind of nail the model, right? because VC is has been struggling, I think. And this is not to say we are not anti-VC. We were VCs ourselves. We've been on both sides of the equation, raised a lot of money for our previous startups, and they're great people in the VC world. It's just that they were so good at branding or something that 10 out of 10 companies felt like they needed VC money, when in reality, it's maybe more like 9 out of 10 companies that should go for that model, and the rest should just be great companies that make money. And I think that the sort of the venture studio model that can kind of lie a little bit in between, and there's a lot of founders that won't get diluted as much and run for the next funding round, and where they don't get the XXX liquidation preference problem later on, and all of this bullshit that also follows this model a bit, and they can a little bit more just kind of build.
But that has always fundamentally been the problem with VC money, right? And I've been always very reluctant to that. It's because it sets up the strategy that your only success criteria is to have a unicorn exit, essentially, because anything short of that is a failure in the book of a VC in general, generally speaking, right? There are people without a thesis, but generally speaking, that's the thesis, right? And it just removes so much value from the market, because there are so many businesses out there that are very good business, are very cash generated business, but there is no path to unicorn, and nor does it need to be a path there, right? So this is kind of why I am intrigued by this concept of, like, how do you short circuit that loop, right? And not going back to like bank loans in the old school, but like finding a model that is somewhere more modern. And that's why like the venture studio model is intriguing to me in general.
We have a specific take on this cash flow side of it in Bifrost. So Bifrost Studios is our venture studio mother company. And I will talk a little bit more about that. But just to kind of touch on what you're saying there, we have something we call the Purple Ocean Filter. Mm-hmm. And for those who don't know, I think that in the US they use like brownfield and whitefield or something.
Greenfield.
Yeah. So it's something similar to that concept where you have like, you know, you're on the one side, you have the red ocean that's like shark infested waters with very low gross margins, and it's like basically selling rice or some commodities, something like that, right?
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, you have the Facebooks of the world, but also the graveyard of startups, right? Where it's like 99% of seemingly good ideas go to die, because you needed to convince, you educate the market, you had long sales cycles, huge R&D costs and complexity and all of that. But in between lies an interesting sort of space where one of our companies that we co-founded, Scalar Finance, where we got like $1 million ARR in 9 months, lies within this kind of mix. There is a kind of the Venn diagram overlap, if you will, where you say, let's take a market that is proven, which is big, where there's clearly a problem, but you want to say, we don't want the long sales cycle, we don't want the long R&D, we want to always be able to know who the ICP is almost immediately, and the CapEx is lower, and you know, you can test out faster, and that is the Purple Ocean Filter for us. So for Scalar Finance, for instance, which is a CFO company, fractional CFO company, but with a heavy amount of kind of systems and software component on top that makes it so the customer can, the kind of, we knew that people were needed, you know, that they needed everything from accounting, bookkeeping, financial modeling, everything that a startup, it's like most startup founders are not very interested in that sort of stuff. I know that you're also looking into the AI CFO that we are now. It's going to be very interesting. We're very hyped about that. But anyways, the point is just there will be markets where you know that there is a huge need and a huge, but nobody made the fractional model or made it with a brand like this. You just need a little bit of a different attack vector. And that's...
And it's kind of like, it's the Uber thesis, right? Like, how do you make something that's accessible only to the 1%, in this case, it's the 1% of the companies out there, to the rest of the segment, whereas Uber made black cars available for the average person, where and here you're making a service that's generally speaking only accessible to larger Fortune 500s and so on, or maybe not Fortune 500s, but larger companies and not startups, right?
Yeah. Exactly. But I don't know, maybe if just to kind of round up the kind of introduction to Venture Studios, it would be meaningful to I brought this one slide at least that we could maybe just to kind of just show what does a normal, or not a normal Venture Studio, but at least how we see a Venture Studio, like what is the process? How do we work in a Venture Studio? Because maybe some of your audience also thinking about maybe we should create a Venture Studio and, and what does it actually look like? So just...
Absolutely. I think in the day of, in the era of AI, CodeGen, Gen AI, I think every nerd out there has been thinking like, how can I create more startups? all right. Perfect.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
So this is your blueprint.
So yeah, this is Bifrost actually builds venture studios, and but within the individual venture studio, it's there will be a process, and depending a little bit on the thesis of the studio, and it's great to have a thesis of the studio. For instance, we just had our Bifrost Defense Studio go through our investment committee, so it's going to be super exciting. That's a very specific kind of vertical. It will come with its own problems, pros and cons. But so we will have to adjust it. But in general, it goes something like you have idea generation. And within the idea generation, it's just like kind of a continuous thing. So for us, for instance, we have a Slack channel where we just put in ideas, all kinds of ideas, also not purple ocean ideas. And then you kind of have a, you build up a bank of ideas. And if you have a strong thesis, then, you know, it will be within the thesis probably, right? So you have ongoing idea mapping. Then you have, or for us, we use the Purple Ocean assessment, and we have kind of small investment committees. And sometimes we take some people from the community and also say, hey, let's try to look at these three very promising ideas and choose one of them. And then,
let me pause there real quick. So, when do you kind of assemble a team for this, right? Do you start with a theme and embed on a theme, team and then a theme, or do you start with an idea and then assemble a team? How do you go about that, or is it a bit of both?
Yeah, so for us, we have something we call the Apollo framework, and it has some different dimensions. One of them is the crew, so especially like the people. So for each individual studio, we believe there are like at least five things that you need. You need leadership, you need a go-to-market person, like head of go-to-market, if you will. You need product. So it could be like either a CTO, CPO, GTPO. You need what we call muscle, which is really just kind of get shit done kind of people. We really like this founders associate type role where it's a little bit younger guys that really, maybe they've had like 3 years at McKinsey or something like that, or it doesn't really matter what it is, but they have proven themselves and they work like, you know, really hard and a lot and just move things along, right? But it could also be a more classical CEO type person, right? And then the last thing that you need, which is more like it's not a person, but it's more like you need domain expertise across that fits the thesis. If you have that, then a lot of the other things that you need to do, which is also within the Apollo framework, I don't know if we will have time to go over it, but at least just to suffice to say, we build out the team first, and then the team will build the idea bank, and they will then be the ones that look at that, does the product validation, the GTM validation, that launch, and then go further out and spin out the company and get maybe a new team to take over. But let's go through the process really kind of methodically, and then people they'll kind of kind of understand it. So you build up the ideas, you have the team that can at least look at what is then you take it through the Purple Ocean assessment, and you make a research paper. And this process will probably take, you know, a few weeks. Then when you kind of did the kind of feasibility study, if you will, you'll go to the idea validation board. And that could also be, if you have a small venture studio, it could also just be whoever is in the venture studio so far. And they say like, okay, we have these three ideas. Which one is the best? And we have some workshops that we go through where we score things and we do things. And then after that, you start the product validation, right? And it's very much about understanding ICP, going out, talking to whoever this idea, there will always be some kind of type of customer, client or whatever that you need to speak to. And then you just dig into the problem and you try to, we love this Charlie Munger approach where we invert our thinking, right? So he said, Charlie Munger said, invert, always invert, right? Because, so we ask like, what is 15 reasons this is going to fail, right? Because if everybody can come up with those, then you can pretty much make a solution for it as well from the beginning instead of realizing that later, right? But you kind of go out and you test your idea with the ICP, understand the idea, and build out the first prototype.
And this is before, so you've done this before you write a single line of code.
Yes. So the it's like we call it simple, lovable, and complete. And it's basically the same as an MVP. And a lot of people have a lot of opinions on what you should call this. I like it because it signifies something. And that is you want a clean signal to what you're actually building. And that's not always about building the perfect product. It's also about building the brand. And a slice of, so the simple, lovable, complete will have more a slice of all of the dimension in a pyramid where the minimum or the minimum viable product would be a little bit more just a back of the envelope solution. So we try to see if the one feature that is very core to this thing, can we also build a kind of a startup brand around it? And also because if you make a solution that is not branded the same way as what you're going to make, maybe that's also, that was what they were reacting to in the first place, right? So you want to make it as close to what you're actually going to build without spending too much resources. And this is kind of, that is the crux of kind of getting really good kind of capital efficiency in the studio, is to understand this. How fast can I go from idea to give the user some sort of perceived value at least, so I can get the signal that I get to some sort of validation. And but that's I think this sort of is, the next step. Yeah, yeah.
This is really interesting, right? Because this is where I've certainly done this myself. And this is hardly something unique to me in the startup world. It's like you're spending a lot of time building things that you do not know if they matter, right? Because you have a theory, they've got a thesis, like we're solving for X, but you don't know what part of X that actually customers will care about. And that quick validation is really interesting, and building a framework around that, like zooming in and being able to pinpoint that exact problem and the branding of said problem is key here. Right? I think that's an elegant way of expressing that, right?
Yeah. And you're very correct. And I think the more mature I've become in my kind of entrepreneur's journey, the more I just realized that everything is about ICP. Like you can never talk too much to your customers. You can never spend too much time understanding what the real problem is, you know? And so that's why we are very much in this ICP discovery kind of thing. And then we try to build out something for them, again, with the high speed, low cost of resources, but still high signal for what the final product will be. Then what will happen is that you get some kind of product. You say like, did we validate this? Did we get a good enough response from, let's say, the design partner cohort or whatever you might, beta tester cohort or whatever you might call it. And say like, and you probably put some targets to how many do we need to kind of care about this or engage at it, what kind of metric it might be, like a pre-revenue metric, like how much value are they getting from this? Get some signal from that, say, okay, that was good. We did that. We built the whatever landing page and the thesis and the kind of thing. And there was a lot of people who wanted this. And then you go into the GTM validation after that, where we kind of try to sell it as well, right? So you also want people to actually swing their card. And this is, of course, a little bit like a gray zone area, but you try to sell your product even if you don't have it. You can always come back and say, bro, here's your money back or whatever, right? But the point is just you want to see that they actually care enough, right? And it's just a good way to kind of get high signal to noise because maybe people are a little bit, you know, they can say many times that, and depending on cultures as well, like, oh, yeah, we want this, but then at the end they don't, right?
I mean, it's a very good point, right? Because people say they want a lot of things, and I'm sure we've both seen this a lot over the years. Like people say they want this, but do they actually care enough to swipe their card? Like it's the same thing with feature development. I mean, you could, like a feature development is a sub-product of this whole problem, right? Because it's like people say they want all, but in reality, it's only this one out of 10 things they really care about, because that's really what solves the problem. The other 9 things are nice to have, right? So zooming in on that is super interesting.
Yeah. For sure. And what you're really doing here is you're de-risking. And if you look at the old VC kind of de-risking graph level, so see like pre-seed, you're de-risking the team. Seed, you are de-risking the product. Series A, you're de-risking the kind of product market fit and maybe seed also the go-to market. And what we're actually trying to do is we're trying to de-risk all the way up to Series A, but like in 2 months.
Yeah.
Because, and that is the power of the Venture Studio model, I think, where you say like, okay, now we know the product, or maybe we build some prototype. Now you can vibe code all of these things. I know you have some opinions of that, but for many of the products that are not like deep tech or hardware or whatever, it's enough that you can get a good response and see like, okay, what's this idea that we're working on? Was it like, yeah. So you have the product ready in the very 0.1 sense. And the idea is then if we can sell that to 100 people, and that's a shitty product. We know we can do much better when we spend the real resources and time on building out the code and doing a much better job on that. Then we can sell it to 10,000 as well, right?
Yeah.
But what you actually now want to de-risk is the GTM side of it, like the go-to-market, right? So so you do the GTM validation as soon as you can, kind of, because that's also just as big as a problem. And especially in a world where you have a hugely saturated marketplace, because of also vibe coding and people are getting smarter and just, you know, like there's so many ideas coming to market. There's so much competition for attention that it might not only be that you created a great product. You also need to find the right channel model fit, as we call it, right?
Yeah.
So that's what you're also trying to prove out with the GTM validation that, okay, now we have the product and seemingly the people in the studio or in the kind of design core, they wanted it, but can we also get it out there? And can somebody swing the card and actually buy it? So that's sort of the next point there. Do you want me to just finish it?
Yeah, it's one question that I like. So you're basically ruling out a lot of possible cohorts, right? Like you're basically saying no slow sales cycles, basically like no enterprise software, like where there needs to be multi-stakeholder sign-offs. Like you're focusing on like what? If you try to do enterprise stuff, like you're not gonna validate anything in like a month. I mean, you might validate something in a year, but it's gonna be that level of sales cycle, right? So I guess that's how do you view that from a is that that's part of like you filtering that out earlier in the process? I guess you like we're not gonna touch anything with slow sales cycles essentially, and like even if it's a massively interesting problem space,
at least then there would have to be some other parts of that build and that whole research and that whole architecture within some sort of B2B product that it could offset it, so it's not the mm-hmm. only dimension, and it's not like binary as such where it's like, oh yeah, we could never do an enterprise product. But maybe what we would rather do, and what I've also seen happen many times when we build businesses, start with smaller customers anyways. And then as the roadmap matures, as your feature kind of set also matures, and you have a full suite of things, you can also move up the ladder and start to sell to bigger. But then you can start out smaller, you can validate, or maybe just find a very novel way to go to market on that idea where you kind of get, you know, you get 10% of the money because they really want it, right? So we had a good example right now. So we built a within the finance and maybe like kind of wealth management space in London, we built out Leopard Labs. And within 3 months, we built the studio, we built the team, we built the first product, and we got like 50 to 100,000 pounds worth of ARR in 3 months, right? And that's that impressive. Was with enterprise type clients, right? So some of the biggest banks and some of the biggest wealth managers in the world are buying our Signal product. We have a hedge fund on the side that where we kind of get some of these leads and we can kind of understand that ICP really well. But it's just to say it's not impossible to sell to people. We just need to find a way where you can then hack it, right? So that's
you basically need to sell on relationships, right? That's the only way you can actually hack that.
Yeah, and we had that. So we said, like, let's build a studio around the fact that we have an unfair advantage. And that's actually how we always think with our studios. We say, if we are to build something within some kind of thesis, who has an absolutely unfair advantage that we can build that around? So we have distribution mm-hmm. already, or we have very deep product knowledge, or we have some. And I would recommend that anybody who's looking into this model, that they don't just build a venture studio, but that they think about, who am I? What is the founder model fit for me?
Yes.
Or find somebody then if they're it's okay to start something new. We all entrepreneurs, well, curious. That's fine. But then just find a team that can then have the domain expertise across. But anyways, just to finish this off, I'd say like to do the GTM validation. Let's say you get your 100 sales or whatever it is. So you say, yeah, we validated the idea. It was people want it, they want to pay for it, they like it, they love it. Then we go ahead and create the founding document, we call it. So the idea of this is, doing all of this, there'll be a lot of workshops, there'll be a lot of artifacts, there'll be a lot of things kind of created that we can now collect into one big document. It'll probably be something like 10 to 25 pages, let's say. Mm-hmm. And what that allows us is that everybody has a shared sense of what actually happened, what went right, what went wrong, when did we pivot, when did we try something new. And then when we then say, okay, we want to actually spin this out and launch it, we now can get a team from outside that will immediately understand what happened, how it came about, and all of that, right? So they will be kind of feeling like they were part of the team from the beginning and were part of all these iterations, so they don't make the same mistakes as we just did. And then our model is then to kind of, you know, get assemble a team. You can either then invest the money from the studio into the idea. You might always already be near cash flow positive at this point, mm-hmm. Because yeah. the validation went beyond your dreams or whatever. Or you can also go out and say, okay, let's make a small fundraise for a small team, let's say 2 to 5 people, probably something like that. Probably use the same dimensions that we from the Apollo framework of who we want to hire. You want leadership, you want GGM, you want product, you want muscle and domain expertise. And then you assemble the team, and then you make a big ship off workshop where it's like typically a couple of days, where we then use another, we call it the liftoff phase, where we have like a kind of a 100 tasks in 100 days sort of thing, where we, you know, you go through the motions, and then it's really off to the races, back to the drawing board, take the next idea, create more equity. So you're kind of creating an equity printer of sorts. This is so superior to a venture approach, because they're going to buy in at a much, much higher valuation. So they both pay more and they get less equity, right? Where we can have considerably more equity, less risk, and spend many more, less resources on it, right?
But talk to me more about this, because I think that's where you do things differently than, I guess, most other studios, is this concept of that the initial team that built and scopes this is not the team that kind of executes on the actual project. They go back to the drawing board. What's the thinking around that? Because I think that's somewhat controversial, right? Because normally they are the one that runs the team, and then maybe they run like five projects in parallel. So walk me through the logic of like completely spinning that out versus just recycling a team. And why, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, so this is a great question. This is something that we've been thinking a lot about, because on the one hand, if you're so successful with a build within the studio that the whole studio transform into one company, that's actually a good outcome. Because that means that you have product market fit, and that's what startup people dream about having, right? So first of all, it's not the worst thing that can happen. But we would still try to not have it happen and rather say, because we want these people to be the core, kind of absorb all of that knowledge and make them really efficient in going through this process over and over again. Mm-hmm. And then maybe once in a while you lose a person to a project because they fell in love with it, or they're like, right, they're indispensable, or there's something that just makes sense in them going there. And then you'll say, like, I just brought up the slide here, like you lose your kind of product guy, right? Then you have to go out and hire a new product guy for the core team, because he will now be the, I don't know, the CEO, maybe even CGO of this project, because he's just, that kind of makes sense for him, right? But in order to avoid, so there's also some, you could say, there's some, what are the bad things about the venture studio model, right? To your question. And there is, in the venture environment, at least we want to go that route, because I also mentioned venture studios that go, there's a build an idea, then we go to VCs. That's like after the validation, basically, right? And that's perfectly fair and reasonable to do. The problem is VCs, they have this kind of, I find it to be quite poor thinking, to be honest. I don't think it clears well when you reason from first principle. But their argument is like, yeah, back in the day, there was like a rule of thumb that the founders should own at least 50% of the Series A, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it doesn't really take into consideration that it's like, okay, but what if they like they're going to stay if they have 8% or 12%. And it's like, that's not what they're doing. They have a great salary and they're still going to make like $10 million here or whatever, right? And it's like, that's not why they're here. But anyways, that's like, there's these rule of thumbs and this herd mentality a little bit in VC. So you kind of have to say, okay, what do we do then? Because they're not going to put in money if the cap table is kind of wonky from their perspective, because they will see the venture studio maybe as a silent partner, even though they don't just get how much work the venture studio actually is doing within each individual business. But either way, it is what it is, right? So what we say is, if we have this sort of venture case scenario, which is not, we like to go default alive. So we want to get cash flow as fast as possible and be a little bit on a sort of, you could say like, you're a bootstrapper, right? And we want to be venture bootstrappers, let's say. So we like this one and done mentality, right? Where we invest enough that, because we already de-risked all of the things that would normally be the reason why you would get a pre-seed round, a seed round, or whatever, right? Then we can do a little bit larger round. Let's say it could be $1 million. It could be a little bit more. But then you say, okay, that's enough to kind of, at least here on the capabilities, the crew side, say like, that's leadership, that's execution muscle, we have GTM, we have domain, we have product, that's it. We don't need more. We have AI, we have tech, we have frameworks, we have everything. We have all these other things now that we can solve the rest. And I saw yesterday there was a guy who exited his one-man company for $80 million, right? So kind of leveraging that thing, and then say, and we go to the default alive. But if it is like, we put in $1 and you get $5. That's a venture case, right?
Yeah.
Then you say, okay, fine, dilute us, whatever. We'll just figure it out, right? It becomes an optionality thing for us then to say, if it's worth that much to get in, I don't know, some big VC that cannot live with us owning more, then we'll just give more equity to the team. And then just take it from there. So it's of course it's a loss from a nominal perspective, but if that means that then we have like $25 million that we can pump into a money machine, then it's like that's not the worst, and then we can go back build a new one, right? It's like that's our thinking on the subject, anyways.
There's a lot to unpack here, right? So the one obvious thing that I think anybody's been in the startup world would immediately jump to here is like equity distribution, right? Like, what does that look like when, particularly in a complex framework like this, where you have like Bitfrost on top, and then you have this team, and then another team? Like, in my head, it's just like, this is very, very messy. Like, you're breaking the mold from like you were saying, with like, here's what you're expected to get at end milestone as a CEO, right? Like, you kind of, if you're a founder of a company, you want to have, you don't want to end up with like, oh, you sell your company and then you're like, oh, you walked out with peanuts, right? So like, walk me through like what you're thinking about equity structures across this for both the initial team that then walks off and hands it off, but then for the team that's coming online, like what does those dimensions look like? I mean, obviously they vary from team to team, but like ballpark.
Yeah. So I think it's very, it depends on the CapEx. Building a defense studio and gonna, you know, probably have to fundraise more than you do if you are doing a venture studio within marketing products or something like that, right?
Yes.
Where it's like, where you can build smaller solutions. But anyways, the core team will own a lot of the equity of the studio, obviously, typically probably 100%, right? And then you say, now we have validated this product. We now need to go out and find a person who is the perfect, I don't know, sort of CEO, refounder, or just, we would just probably call them founders actually of each, because it's just better. And it would be up to them to then say how much equity should they have. But I would say that would probably per person be more than this person would get if he joined a startup. That would have a smaller percentage chance of succeeding, because they are not de-risked as much as we are de-risked when we do the product market, when we do the validation and the GTM. And ballpark, so, I would say 10, 20%, something like that for a person like this. And I would probably think that, and now I had a lot of venture cases as well, right? Where it's like, it's very typical that you join, you get like 1%.
Yeah, I guess the controversy is that you call them founders, but you're giving them first employee equity, I guess.
Yeah, so
I guess
it's in between kind of thing, right? A little bit like with the one and done. It's between bootstrapping and venture. It's between founder and employee. But there is a lot of these founders that we found that has like, we mostly want to work with exited founders for the same reason that we talked about earlier, that they kind of get it, right? So they very instantly understand the model. But it is up to the venture studio. It's up to us as a venture studio and as a venture studio creator to really get the best talent. And it's very kind of from good to great. If anybody read that book, right? It's about if you get the right people on the bus, they'll do great things. They can help themselves, right? Yeah. But of course, but there's a lot of entrepreneurs who also tried all the other ways, and they like this kind of thing where they are heavily compensated, and if it becomes big, they'll still make like tens of millions of dollars, but they also have a salary. But it's like this kind of we need to find this, because there's also a lot of these corporate venture studios that does not do well. They do very poorly. Corporate, I don't know, incubators or whatever they are, right? And the problem with them, as I see it, is they don't give much equity, and they have too much compliance and all of that. And they attract, there are good people everywhere, so I don't take this the wrong way, but like entrepreneurs, let's say. They're not really entrepreneurs. They're more like they've worked in some other corporate, and now they want to be founders. And then they go to these corporate kind of places, and being very, let's say, hardcore, diehard entrepreneurs, we know what a real entrepreneur looks like, and that's the one. That's the people that we want to recruit to put into to this kind of situation. And maybe also if you find like a super superstar, it's like, yeah, you're gonna have 50% of the company if that's what it takes, you know. But I think it would be something like that normally per person, right? In between the models.
Okay, and the other question I have here is, you're talking about a one-off fundraising event, which is rare. Like, because that's you're breaking the mold here, because that's not how normally fundraising is done, right? Like people like this is the first out of many, right? Until you either IPO or you go bust. Like those are generally speaking like the two dimensions of fundraising. Like you keep going until some event happens, right? What has the appetite been for that, and how does that resonate with, I guess, traditional VC? Or are you going into like family offices instead, which is slightly more flexible investment thesis? Or like, how have you seen that? Like, because that's an interesting one.
Yeah. So for the investor type, just to take that question first, I definitely say that there is a lot of family offices, a lot of kind of super angels or high net worths that are probably easier in the beginning if you want to create a venture studio to talk to, because they kind of get it a little bit more. You do, where if you talk to institutionals, it might be a too new model for them or something like that. And if you talk to venture, then there's also cap table issue, and also there's a little bit of animosity between venture and venture studios, because we're sort of eating their lunch a little bit, and they don't like it much. And but there are also great people in the VC space that kind of totally recognizes. And actually, very interestingly, Sequoia became like, Andreessen became a kind of a hybrid fund now that is like this everlasting vehicles. They're going into PE, these kind of, there's a lot of changes happening in this. So I think this view is also changing. But I would definitely say that to get that first one and done, you probably want to more go for these sort of family office type, because they also like, at least for our model, which is a little bit more cash flow heavy, they like that. They want to see dividends. They want to, you know, they come from GAAP accounting, right? They're like, they want to see EBITDA. But if you then have a venture case, or you are in a space that is a little bit more venture friendly, maybe more deep tech, or maybe very high octane somehow, or you just simply hit the right kind of product market fit with the right channel model fit, then definitely go to VC, and then you just negotiate. And it's always like that with fundraising. I think that the better your case, the more you can kind of, you know, you have more leverage, right?
I mean,
so at the end
like
of the day, if you have something, right, you can get them to invest for sure.
It's like the old saying goes, right? Like, raise money where you don't need it, right?
Yeah, for sure. And but in the end of the day, if you do that, then you're just in that race, and that's fine.
Yeah.
Because that's also a way to get to the exit. It's just it's not our default model.
Right.
It's our optional model. That's how it's in.
Yeah. Okay. The other thing I wanted to cover, so we covered a bit of you, how you're thinking about this, how you kind of evaluate ideas, how you go to market, all that stuff. That's super interesting. The other thing that I guess I spoke a bit about on my podcast with Kevin Henriksen about micro PE, right? Because you have also a thesis around buying business as well, right?
Yes.
I've heard this from more than one friend by now, like people who are getting into this kind of like I guess buying boomer business is one way to put it, right? Like you, I think you put it in similar terms before when we've chatted about this, right? Buying businesses with a thesis of people that there could be a lot more efficiency gained. Like talk to me about your thesis around that.
Yeah. So I was just thinking if you bring up something here, so it would be a little bit easier to understand. But
sure.
Let's just try to take it without any slides, but. So basically, what we discovered was that, okay, we can build companies really fast. Well, at least we can de-risk the kind of we can de-risk the process really fast. So get from, we call this from 0 to 1, right? But what we also found, because we took over a couple of companies more or less for free that had revenue, product market fit, but maybe they were in a situation where the founder kind of was burned out, or maybe they were, you know, they only had some dimensions of the crew that you'd need, and therefore they didn't build the right brand, they didn't have the right go-to-market motion, or whatever it might be, but they're still profitable or break even, right? And we took over this company and said, like, hey, if we can run it from 0 to 1 through the process, we can also just run it through from 1 to 2 and just kind of upgrade the company, right? Because it's very much it's a craft, right? And if you have the right processes, frameworks, and all these playbooks, then you can do the same with a bigger company as well. And so that's why we found that, oh shit, it's such a layup for us. Also, as we did it, that we found out, oh, okay, we can make a turnaround happen in 3 to 6 months, right? So it kind of dawned on us that what we've been doing on the acquisition front, which was a little bit more in the beginning, was more an opportunistic thing and kind of dabbling in it, that it became like a real thesis around what we call venture roll-up. So we say that we build and buy profitable companies. That's kind of what we do, right? And our thesis is now have become much more whole, and it's going to be within the financial services kind of companies. So we're talking about accountancies, tech advisory, all of salary, budgeting, all of these bookkeeping companies, because there is a huge sort of wealth kind of transfer happening at the moment. It's probably the biggest wealth transfer that ever happened in the history of the world, because the baby boomer generation is the biggest one. They have the most assets, and they are getting old, and they need to go on pension, or they're dying off also. And that is within the thesis that we have in this space, in the financial services space, just in the US, where we'll be operating this specific strategy. There is 88,000 companies that need to kind of transition, or I think like 50% or something of that kind of cohort needs to transition within the next 5 years. And these are all companies with, say, an enterprise value between $1 million and $5 million. And that is the micro private equity space.
Right.
And the reason why this is interesting in the first place for us is that and maybe for also a lot of other people, there are search funders, and there's boring businesses. There's a lot of people talking about these kind of things, right? But for us, it is private equity. It's too small for them, because typically they raise, like, let's say $500 million, billions of dollars. And then they say, like, we're going to diversify, but mostly we have to, you know, we cannot buy 1,000 small companies, right? The operations of it. And also, so they're more like, if you look at it on a traffic light, right, it'll be like, there'll be some dimensions, like whatever, sales, brand, people, whatever, that some of it is green, some is red and some or yellow and some is red, right? And for private equity, normally it would be more like green, 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 yellow, green, green, because it's such big transactions that and they will have some strategic advantage where they can roll up the revenue yeah. into an even bigger company. And it has to work because else it's catastrophic. So they do a lot of due diligence and they put a lot of McKinsey people on it and they really make sure that it's going to work, right? But yeah. we are entrepreneurs. We're like craftsmen, right? We're like, we can go in and say, like, as long as it's not a negative cash flow situation or like that we're losing money, we're okay. We're actually, the more red we have, the better, right? Because then we can put that through the process, create a new brand, create a new go-to-market funnel, create a new whatever, work with the company and make it better, right? So, and yeah. and just, I know this is a little bit long, but just stay with me. The economics of it is super interesting because for the people who want to sell their companies, there are not any buyers in this space really, right? Which means that the multiples and revenue is nowhere near the stock market or near the whatever when you talk with VCs on how much multiple would they give you on your ARR or whatever, right? So they're more like 2, 3, 4
and we're
times
talking
EBITDA
multipliers, EBITDA. Not ARR multipliers,
no,
which is a huge difference, right?
Gigantic difference. So it's actually on the profit, right? But within our thesis, right, this is what we're discovering. That is probably, and a lot of them, their alternative is just close down because they're like, I need to go in pension now, I'm too old, yeah. you know, like, or whatever. But they have like, I have 1,000 customers, I'm making $500,000 a year. And they're like, okay, you can buy it out for 3.5 times EBITDA. And then it's like, when you bought that, and then you see, holy shit, there's a lot of problems with the company, but it's still making $500,000 a year, right? They say, yeah. like, even if I don't do anything, I will make my money back in 3 years, right? Because yeah. this is literally the profits, right? And when you then, and I don't know how much people know about it, depends on the listeners, but like the in private equity, you have this thing called a roll-up, right? So you have a platform company, and then you take companies that are smaller, and then you buy them and put them in. So this is how most of big mergers and acquisitions actually work. You yeah. take that revenue, you put it into the platform company, and because that company is in the stock exchange or something like that, that revenue will now be recognized at a much higher multiple on the EBITDA. So it might go from 7 to 10. So they instantly make 30% on the valuation that way, right? Yeah. We can just do that even more because we're so low down. So if we roll up enough of these companies and we also build the brands up, we do a lot of different things, then we both move the total revenue and we also move the multiple. And that's the case. That's the case yeah. that we are working on. So it's a bit long, but
yeah,
it's a complicated subject.
No, but I think it's interesting, right? Because I think there's a lot of lessons here for both existing entrepreneurs and people looking to do things, right? Because I think one thing that really was interesting, because I had a offline chat with Kevin about this stuff, and we talk about like the innovations that you can apply to these companies. And like as tech entrepreneurs, we're like thinking like, oh, you need to rewrite code, you need to do some complicated like process innovation. Like, no, like innovation could literally be like, oh, you move to like electronic signatures rather than like yeah. and like the receptionist going and give papers to this. Like it's like the innovation is so trivial in our mind that we don't even consider it tech innovation, but it actually has a real implication in these businesses, right? If you could actually like apply this, as I thought yeah. that was an interesting one, right?
Yeah, it's a very interesting point to touch upon because entrepreneurs as a cohort, they live very much in the future, right? So yeah. they are a very leading cohort, and sometimes when you just, you know, you have somebody calling me.
That's right.
When you're surrounded by this group of people, then you're kind of like, aren't everybody investing in bitcoins and you know using AI and doing all these right. things? And then when in the real economy, that's not really the truth, right? So when you yeah. go into this kind of companies and you realize, holy shit, they're using fax machines and stuff right. like that, right? And you're like, there's some efficiency to be had here, right?
Yeah.
And we are building. And one of the reasons then also why we think that this specific thesis makes a lot of sense, other than being a lot of targets and to kind of look at, is that we have built this type of company already with scale up. And kind of a, let's say, 2.0 tech-enabled service company that is now where we are now very soon to release the first true really big AI CFO. So we spent like $20-30 million on kind of getting to that point where we could develop develop this technology, and it's going to be completely awesome. So when we take that into the into these type of businesses, and they basically just become clients of Scaleup, right? Or Noom, as it were, then we think that we can probably take their gross margin from 20% to 50%. So right. if you think about that, right, that doubles the amount of EBITDA that is there, and we then also double the multiple, or maybe triple the multiple on that EBITDA, and that's not even touching the top funnel, right? Then you have a very explosive sort of case with very low risk. So it's an asymmetric opportunity.
Yeah, because you've de-risked because they already have a customer base, and then you kind of transitioning them from a service company to product company almost, right? Exactly. Which is like a huge difference in valuation between those two, right?
Yeah, that's what Jonathan, our head of this division, like our micro private equity, our private equity division in his in New York, that he is very interested in that whole transformation, which is also very brand heavy. But it's also just implementing a lot of these technologies that we actually know how to do. And it, for many, probably many entrepreneurs, there's a lot of these sort of opportunities where they could go in an old, boring space and take something that is trivial to them, as you say, and really knock it out the park in that sector.
Yeah, no, and I think that leads me to a pretty good last talking point, which is we can't have a podcast in this day and age without talking about AI. You was talking a bit about things that kind of ties into the whole thesis of Bitfrost around the future outlook. Like, if I mean, let's put aside the tool, the Gen AI tools we have today, all that stuff, because there are a lot of like how the rate of innovation and all those, the rate of how much they get better. We can talk about how good they are today versus what they can potentially be. That's a separate discussion. But what I was curious about your conversation about that was your future outlook of where would we go 5, 10, 15, 20 years out. Like, you had some interesting takes on that. I thought that was actually something that's interesting to take on air as well.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So, I think this, everybody should care about this, right? Because it's like probably the biggest transformation that have ever happened in human history or something like that, right? Mm. It's like at least on par with the internet and probably bigger, really, because it has many wider ramifications, maybe more like the Industrial Revolution, maybe even more than that as well. And so my outlook is probably, so I've been trying to kind of study this problem, and it seemed like a lot of people, they're kind of making the, you know, like putting their head in the sand a little bit, because they kind of, it's an uncomfortable subject also, right? Mm. And I've been delving a lot into these post-labor economics. So it's like a kind of an emergent school of economics, you could kind of say. Shout out to David Shapiro, who is kind of leading a lot of this. What is kind of talking about is that the sort of heterodoxy of other economic schools, like whatever you have, Keynesianism or Chicago School or classical or Austrian economics, whatever it is, there are none of these economics that take into consideration what happens when you have another apex species, basically. Like, and what the post-labor economics is talking about is like the four dimensions, right? When automations and robots and in kind of a, and I'm not so much trying to predict, is this happening in 3 years, in 5 years, in 9 years, or for 30 years? It's more just everybody agrees it's going to happen. It's just a question of when do robots and automation become better? They're already arguably better, faster. They're faster on some things. They're very slow on other things. Robotics are not very good at everything yet. And that's probably like an Optimus thing, right? They're cheaper. They're cheaper on some things now. They are very much expensive on other parts. It still makes sense to use labor in a lot of things, but maybe one when Optimus robot costs $1 to operate an hour and they are safer as well, right? Mm. Because they don't mind crawling up in the top of the Empire State Building and fixing the whatever thing, right? They're just gonna do whatever they want and can work 24 hours. So you have this better, faster, cheaper, safer sort of outlook. And if you look at the economy, just kind of from a Western global-ish kind of outlook, you'll probably say that 60 to 80% of all the consumption and demand of the economy comes from wages. So it's like basically employees getting paid, right? Then you have maybe 20%, depending on the country. Denmark is probably like 40% or something very high, is transfers from the government, so kind of redistribution of wealth. And then you have probably something like 10 to 20% as well that is property based. So that means you have stocks that give you dividend, you have a second apartment that you rent out, these sort of things, right? And what's interesting to think about, I think, and that this is a question that everybody should be asking themselves, is what happens when that, and this is the research that I'm that I've seen, when this over whatever time span it is, but it's probably more 7 years than 15 years, I would say, that these 60 to 80% wages goes to 20% of the economy. That is a huge delta, like difference between these numbers is huge. And that's a lot of unemployment, right? Where there will be a transition phase to a new economy. And I'm not saying that then everything will collapse or something like that, but it's just to say it's going to be very kind of birthing phase of a new, potentially super abundant society, because the distribution of that new GDP, maybe we go to growth rates of 7% and you know we can 100x the global economy over 50 years. But if nobody is getting that GDP growth kind of distributed in the right way, we're going to have very social strife, sort of revolutionary problems. Yeah. So anyways, yeah. It's a very big topic.
It's a really interesting one, right? Because I mean, not only do you have massive unemployment potentially then, but you also have far fewer. I mean, if you come look at tax contribution, right? Like that's a huge part of where tax are collected from is from payroll. Mm. So that is interesting. So where do you see that? Like, are all roads leading to UBI, or where's your head out around that? Because I thought it was interesting, like overlaying the thesis around Bitfrost and both company creation and also like how you see that.
Yeah, so we just had a great event with Bifrost in the UK. We got all the founders together and we're trying to discuss this more from a sort of both on a personal level, like what investments should you hold, how do we protect your family in this situation, but also from a business perspective. And the Venture Studio model lends itself really well to this kind of environment, we think, because when there is a lot of change, there'll be a lot of opportunity as well. Mm. And to kind of think about what businesses should we build, what will change, and because let's say that all roads do lead to UBI. And for those who are not familiar with the concept, universal basic income, UBI is basically just a welfare kind of program where we give everyone, not depending on how much they make or even some amount of money, just to kind of baseline the economy. And the reason why this also is kind of makes sense, and I'm talking from completely apolitical point of view here, because I come from a very libertarian kind of tradition, let's say, but I can see that there is probably no other way, because if you don't have the demand side of the economy, it's not very fun to be a Mag 7 company either, right? Because if nobody's buying your AI or whatever thing, then there is some kind of collapse in the whole economic paradigm. That doesn't make any sense, especially in a debt, very highly leveraged society, right? So it's also in their interest. Also, it's no fun being a millionaire when there is a social strife and revolution and you cannot go out in the street, right? So it's in everybody's interest to kind of say, okay, we need some solution here, right? And UBI will probably maybe we'll start with UBI. What I probably kind of foresee will happen is we'll go to some unsustainable amount of unemployment at some point in X amount of years. I don't want to guess because it's simply too hard, but somewhere after 27, 28, it will start to become very apparent for governments that, and some new parties will be like, we are the UBI party, or we are the universal high income party or whatever, right? And they'll start to tax the shit out of these mega corps. So if you're in the top 100 companies, you'll get like some extra mega tax that probably they won't care. I think that there is some game theory here where it is actually in everybody's interest, which can create there's of course a lot of problems with it, but let's just say that it is in everybody's interest to have also demand for your products, right? Yes. So I think that but I think what will happen first is that we get some sort of economic problem, right, where they're not realized this in time. And I think what I've seen research wise is like, if you had 14% unemployment, like on a structural level, then it's catastrophic. And if you look at the Great Depression, for instance, unemployment went to 25-30%, but for 6 months, right? And then it went sort of back, and that was very catastrophic, right? And they didn't have much depth compared to what we have now, right? So if you go to, if you had those levels at a sustained environment, and a sustained kind of time frame, then it's extremely problematic, right? So I think that the response will be something like that. And there's a lot of these other things they could do. So sovereign wealth funds will become a much bigger component, I think, also. Like, so Norse fund, the Norwegian
wealth fund. The only successful sovereign fund in the world.
and there are all these, especially in the Middle East, they have a lot of sovereign wealth funds, and the US are creating sovereign wealth funds. And these will all start to capture. So we need to go to basically a property-based system where people also get ownership, because from a very human perspective, there will be a lot of kind of spiritual and emotional problems with no longer being able to kind of have a purpose, you could say, right? That is very obviously be given by your job right now. Not that I say that it should be like that, but it's just there will be some meaningless problem where people will then say, okay, how can I get back into to be something? And that would probably be owning property in, it could be whatever, right? When I say property, I don't mean properties like real estate. It could also be that, but I just mean like that the lowest part of society will be on UBI, and they'll probably, as always, hit the people who have the more menial jobs first. And then and all of those transfers will then still kind of sustain the economy, but you will try to say, okay, can we go together in this DAO or collective to own something together and have at the higher amount of income that will come from property generated, also there will still be salaries, there will still be jobs, there will be much, much less. I'm not saying that everybody will be out of a job, actually. I'm just saying that it's a problem if 50% are going to be out of a job, right, from an economic perspective. But so we need a lot of new sources of income for everyone that is relies more on property and less on transfers, and that will be the battle of the political future, I think.
And I think that's fine. Torbjørn, this has been super interesting. Anything closing notes on you want to get to the audience before we wrap up for today?
We are fundraising, of course. So that's interesting. I don't think I'm allowed to talk too much about it. But Bifrost is raising fund too. But it's always great to talk to anyone interested in what we're doing at Bifrost or with founders who are thinking about this model. And you know, we are always trying to create a great network around us. It's very much what one of the big parts of what we do. So feel free to hit me up on LinkedIn or whatever.
Good stuff. Perfect. Again, thanks so much for coming on the show, Torbjørn.
Thank you, Victor. It was a blessing.
Cheers.